Very good.
Still missing a few people?
Nah. Okay, so another talk, another day. Sorry? So, one thing which people were asking, well, they always seem to ask at this time, so, well, you talked a lot about the meditation and getting very still and really peaceful, but people make a lot about insight and insight meditation. And I did also mention that the Satipatthana, Anapanasati, it's all the same. In other words, they all lead to a calming of the mind and a seeing of what's really happening. And there is the old, not an old, it's one of the sayings in the Dhammapada, one of my favorites, is that there is no jhana without wisdom. There's no wisdom without jhana. And the one who has both wisdom and jhana is in the presence of nibbana. So we always have the wisdom which supports, or even you can say the insight supports the stillness, and the stillness supports the insight. Which is one of the reasons why when people come up and they say, well, how do you know, you know, you've got insight? How do you know you've got some wisdom? Because everybody thinks they're wise. But how many people are really wise? And of course, the sign of wisdom is that you are still, imperturbable, that things don't upset you, that the stuff of life, the praise and the blame, people like you, they don't like you, you're sick, you're healthy, you're wealthy or you're poor, whatever. It's those sorts of things. They do not disturb you. In other words, a sign of insight, of understanding, is that you are still, stable, content, serene. And so, you can tell how much insight a person has by how peaceful they are. So, a couple of stories about that. There was one, I haven't told you how I became enlightened, have I? Do you want to know?
Yes.
Yeah, oh, yeah, no, shush. Let's spoil it. So, my fourth Rains retreat. Oh, that's 40 years ago that this happened. And I was in a very simple, peaceful monastery in the northeast of Thailand. And it wasn't Ajahn Chah's monastery, it was a branch monastery in the province of Roi Et. And then, there I was, nothing much to do, no much duties, very simple place. And, you know, you were meditating and walking and no duties, no teaching. And so you had full 3 months to really get into the meditation. And of course, sometimes, you know, the meditation's really hot, you really get into it, you got some power. Other times it's a bit of a struggle. But that afternoon, the meditation really started to get deep. And so in the evening, I was walking and sitting and walking, and especially doing the walking meditation. I was walking and got very still and really energized. You know, when you know everything becomes very bright, even though it's darkness in night time. And my mind was getting brighter and brighter and seeing more things and getting lots of energy and lots of happiness. And of course, once those things start to happen, you have all these insights. They just come, you don't look for them. They just keep coming. Wow, wow, how come I haven't seen that before? Amazing, wow! And you're getting more and more energized, more and more piti, sukha, joy and happiness. And then, must be at about 11 p.m., the big one hit me. Wow. Incredible insight. This was it. I thought, wow, another enlightened being has arisen in Thailand. And there was absolutely no hindrances to be seen. Even though it was the middle of the night, no sleepiness at all. I just walked, sat, and when it got to about 1 p.m. or 1:30, the bell went at 3 o'clock. So I thought, well, I should just go and lay down. But you lay down in your hut, no fatigue at all, no tiredness, it was just laying down meditation. And no, I didn't fall asleep, just so still, you didn't need sleep. And no, the bell hadn't rung yet, so I was up at 2:30, and I sat in the hall. Not air conditioned, it was open to the mosquitoes and everything. And I was sitting there, so peaceful, not sleepy at all. And the bell went, and the monks came in, and there's only a few monks, and then they started the chanting. And the chanting, especially when you're sleepy, is very depressing. Yasa Bhagava Arahamsa. There's no energy at that time of the morning. But for me, Yasa Bhagava! I was really into it. I had just full power. I couldn't stop myself. I thought I was a bit crazy, but I was enjoying it. And then, afterwards, meditating. So peaceful. So still. And then, of course, we got ready for the alms round. And when I walked alms round in the village, every person who put just a small piece of sticky rice in my bowl, I said, you don't know how fortunate you are this morning, giving alms to a new enlightened being. And I blasted them with loving kindness. Full power. And when I got back, the only thing you get on the alms round was just the rice and maybe some bananas or an orange in season or something. So it was only very small stuff because most of the food was actually cooked in the monastery kitchen. The villagers would come and do that cooking. And they'd already done the cooking ready for the meal. And usually it was the same every day. The same pot of rotten fish curry with your sticky rice. Now, what is rotten fish curry? They usually caught the fish in the paddy fields during the rains retreat. There was a one time then when there was a source of protein. And to this day we don't know where those fish came from. There was floods, but I always thought they must be somehow lay their eggs in the soil and then they lay there until the water comes. It's really weird. But anyway, the paddy field fish was what people survived on. So during the rains retreat, and of course when the first rains come, that was when the frogs came out. So that's what you ate. And if anyone was a vegetarian, there's always the water buffalo placenta. That's vegetarian. It doesn't affect the water buffalo at all. It's just discarded. It's disgusting, but it's discarded. But anyway, so the rotten fish, they take a lot of those fish and they store them for the rest of the year. And all they store them in is just those earthen bowls, which they make, earthen jars they make themselves, and they put a bit of plastic over the top to preserve them. And then, you know, it just goes, it goes smelly, goes off, just like, you know, like blue cheese, or like when they used to catch these ducks and stuff and hang them up until they go game, in other words, they go stinky, and that's when it becomes delicious, apparently. So that's what they would do with the fish, until they go all stinky and rotten. And to describe roughly, you know, what it was like when I was cleaning around the kitchen area. Because, you know, you see the monks, we do work, make sure we contribute. And I found one of these jars, and this is no exaggeration, the plastic topping had been perforated, and the flies had laid eggs, and it was crawling with maggots. And so, of course, I said, no, I can't go and throw this away. It's been infested with maggots. And so I was taking it to throw it away. And the headman of the village, who was the most refined of all of them, that's why he was headman of the village, he said, what are you doing? And I said, it's got maggots in it. It's gone off. I'm throwing it away. He said, no, you're not throwing it away. Give it to me. That's extra protein. And that's what we had the next day. True. So anyway, but you got used to it after a while. It's the same every day. So this rotten fish curry, the rotten fish supply deck. And then this day, I couldn't believe it, there was another pot of curry. So where did this one come from? And this was, something which, it was, a pork curry. And that was actually just, sort of edible. It was actually, it was not so disgusting as the other curry. And I thought to myself when I saw these two pots of curry, why is it that this morning in particular there is an edible curry, the pork curry? And I thought, wow, the heavenly beings are celebrating my enlightenment. And I thought, how apt, how appropriate. So I was sitting there, I was number two in the line there, and the abbot, who was the local boy, he came from that village, after giving the blessing, it was only about six monks there, so we served ourselves. So he had his two big pots there. And even though he grew up on the rotten fish curry, he took about three or four, huge ladles of the pork curry. No one could eat that much. And I thought, well, it doesn't matter because there's plenty for me left. You know what he did left? Next, after taking his own, he didn't have any rotten fish curry, and taking his own pork curry, then he took the whole saucepan, the pot, and he poured them together and he stirred them up, saying, it's all the same, it's all the same. And I said, if it was all the same, why didn't you mix it up first before you took yours? You are a hypocrite. And look, now I have to eat the rotten fish curry together with the beautiful pork curry. You spoiled my celebration of my enlightenment. That's just not on. You're a hypocrite. You're greedy, taking far too much. What sort of abbot are you in this monastery, to the senior monk there? And that's when I got this great insight. I wasn't enlightened after all. And if you've ever had that sort of, if you want to know what depression is like, real depression, oh no, because you're really high and then you're really low. And so realizing I wasn't enlightened after all, that was such a bummer. That was such a low point in my monastic life. And so I didn't care what I ate. I just banged a couple of ladles of the mixed rotten fish curry in my bowl and I just ate it and just was fed up all day. So that's the way you know you have insight, by seeing if you can be at ease no matter what happens in your life. So the sign of insight is calm. You're calm no matter what. Okay, people do these things, that's up to them. And the sign of calm is you get insight, you get understand things, real things. Even here, we sweep the ground, sweep the paths, but it's really important in the forests, in the jungles, because if you don't sweep the paths, all sorts of bugs and snakes and things which regard your toes as their dinner, as their lunch, depending on what time of the day, and you get bitten by them, or even sort of really harmed by them. So in those jungles, we'd always spend so much time sweeping the paths, so if there was a snake come, we'd actually see it and we could avoid it. Otherwise, just walking through the forest, through twigs and branches, you don't know what hits you. So anyway, that gave rise to a beautiful simile from an Ajahn Chah. He said that if a leaf falls in a forest, just in the unswept areas, it just disappears amongst the mass of other leaves. You can't really understand it or see it even. But if a leaf falls on a path which has been newly swept, there's just one leaf amongst this sandy white path, and that's all you can see. And that's when you can really understand and explore and find out what that leaf is. So it was a simile for when you clear the path, when you calm the mind, so you're not thinking of too many things, when even one thought or one insight just falls into the cleanly swept mind, it becomes quite easy to see. We understand it because it's not confused with all the other tangle of stuff which we have to deal with in life. So when we simplify things, and then when one thing comes up, we give it full attention, and we can understand it, we can penetrate it, understand what it is. But in life, there's sometimes so much stuff going on, you know, that we go through the whole of life confused because everything is so entangled. So that's one of the also reasons why, for insight, we try and have a simplicity, calm, a mind which is hardly any thoughts coming in at all. So when one thought comes in, it's very easy to see and explore. And it's not followed immediately by a thousand other thoughts. So we know it, we actually do get insight, we understand things, which is, you know, amazing. Just how, when you've got a simple mind, look, for example, that, please don't ask me where those two bad bricks are, the two crooked bricks. Some of you, because you're going to go to the cave this afternoon? Yeah. So oh, can we see the two bad bricks as well? You know, that particular story, this is a good example of stillness and insight. I mean, these are insights which really help you right throughout your life, both in ordinary life and in meditation. And, you know, even leading to the deep insights of enlightenment. So the story was, you know, that first got Bodhinyana Monastery, just a block of land, no money, really poor. I mean, we were in debt, with no place to sleep. So over there, the first night of Bodhinyana Monastery, we went there, we decided, we had... what we did, we slept, you know, above the ground, because if you sleep on the ground, there's all sorts of ticks and bugs and ants. So we slept above the ground on a platform, which was a second-hand old door. So I managed to get two doors from the salvage yard. Because I was a junior monk and Ajahn Jaka was senior, he got the best door, which was flat. My door was like ribbed. But it did have an advantage, that where they usually have the door handle, in this door, the door handle was actually originally in the middle of the door. So there's a big hole in the centre of the door. Quite a large hole, maybe 4 inches. And so I was sleeping on the door, so I never needed to get up in the middle of the night if I want to urinate. It was a very, 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 very interesting design. But the first night, you know, we did some chanting in the middle of the property, and then we were supposed to go back to our doors to sleep. But, you know, I had a flashlight. Even the flashlight, the batteries were really dead. And so, you know, walking around, I couldn't find my door. Walking around for an hour, so what do you do? I just found a tree and just slept underneath a tree, just like kangaroo. Really cold. So it was, you know, very tough. But when we did actually get some money, all we could do was to get building materials. So we couldn't actually afford a builder. So you learned how to build with the pipes and the brickwork and the putting on roofs. It's good fun. But eventually, that when we did the brickwork, I really tried hard to make every brick perfect until eventually that when I finished my wall, you know what happens? It's only afterwards you look back and two bricks were crooked And I don't know how I'd miss those. And of course what happens is, because everyone, all the other bricks were okay, those two really stood out. Just like the simile, the insight of when a leaf falls on a clear path, you can see that leaf clearly. It stands out. So I was trying to take out the mortar to reset the brick. That didn't work because the mortar was like diamond. It was so solid. And then I decided to ask the other monk, Ajahn Jagro, can we afford some dynamite? I wanted to blow the wall up and start again. We couldn't. Couldn't afford it. So I was stuck with that wall for 3 months. And people, you know, sometimes if I was showing them around, I'd take them somewhere else. I was really embarrassed about my mistakes. And I also was, you know, you have nightmares. You wake up in the middle of the night sweating. You dream of the terrible wall, what you've done. And I think, oh, why did I do that? It's just so stupid. And I thought, people will see that. We'll never get any donations. They'll see we're wasting everything. And I was just so upset about that for 3 months. Until that time came, you probably all know the story, that a gentleman was with me. They saw that wall. They said it was a beautiful wall. And I said, you must be kidding. Are you blind? Can't you see the two bad bricks which spoil it? And what he said was, where you get the insights from. And you were ready for those insights because you suffered so much for 3 months, and then they made you see it in a slightly different way, and that changed the whole picture. They said, yes, I can see the two bad bricks, but I can also see the 998 good bricks. You know that for 3 months I couldn't see anything other than my mistakes. All I'd ever see was the two bad bricks. Every time I went past them, my eyes would just go to the two bad bricks. And I was a blind one. I could not see anything other than my mistakes. The gentleman was correct. It was a good wall. But I couldn't see it until he pointed out the good bricks. And so I was ready for those sorts of insights. I mean, they are very powerful insights. You may think they're simple, you've heard it before. But that particular story got me an invite years ago to Bangkok, because somehow or other that story got into the Australian Embassy in Bangkok. And there were four couples. Two couples had already separated, and two other couples were doing a trial separation. And they read that story, and they understood, and they went back together again. The family got reunited just because of that story. Because what was happening? Husband, wife, just seeing two bad bricks and being totally blind to all the other wonderful things which they were sharing together. The mistakes, they were obsessing about the two faults in one another, and that's all they could see, so they couldn't stand each other. Do you understand? Simple things like that. So, you've been here for 8 days or 7 days or something like that, and then you think, oh, I'm going tomorrow, I didn't get my jhanas or enlightenment. Oh, come on. Don't look at the bad bricks of your meditation. Look at the good things which happened in the last few days. You know, you got lots of wisdom, relaxed, found a nice teddy bear to cuddle. You've learned a lot, you've relaxed, you've been at peace. So isn't that good enough? But if you just look at the two bad bricks, what you didn't get, then that's when you get fed up and angry and disappointed and frustrated. And it's also that in the meditation, sometimes I ask people just, well, you're sitting down. If you're a Buddhist, you're doing what the Buddha said, meditating. That's enough for me. The very fact I can just cross my legs and close my eyes and then just meditate, oh, that's enough. Anything else is bonus. You get delightful breath, that's bonus. You get jhanas, that's an incredible bonus. But it doesn't matter, don't get jhanas, just so I can sit here and be peaceful. that's enough for me. So what we're doing there with that simile of the two bad bricks is we're understanding what a fault-finding mind is. You can find fault with anything. Your bed. You know, the mattress is not thick enough, or the mattress is too thick. The food. Sometimes people say here, this meditation retreat is too comfortable. The food is too delicious. Because it means, you know, if it wasn't that delicious, we wouldn't eat so much, so we wouldn't have so much loss and torpor after lunch. Oh, come on. So sometimes it's so easy to blame others. When you blame others, you can't find any happiness anywhere in the world. There was this lady went to see the doctor. I said, what's wrong? He said, my whole body hurts. What do you mean your whole body hurts? Well, look, I'll show you. I touch my forehead, that hurts. Touch my nose, that hurts. And I touch my chest, that hurts. I touch my bottom, that hurts. I touch my knee, that hurts. I touch my foot, that hurts. The doctor said, I know why, because you've got a broken finger. So that simile, it means, if you've got a fault-finding mind, the broken finger, everything hurts. Everything is not good enough. Everything is bad. So if you don't have a broken finger, that doesn't hurt, that doesn't hurt, that doesn't hurt. Does that hurt? No. So there's lots of insights which we get which help us in our life. And in our death, and in our relationships, and in our business. Sometimes people think, well, you know, if you're going to be enlightened, if you're going to be meditate, if you're going to be wise, it means you can't do business. Of course you can do business. I am very successful at my business. It's not monkey business, don't say that. But you do learn a lot when you are. It's just simple things, like just one thing at a time. That great insight of, you know, that insight of moving the wheelbarrows full of dirt. Now, that was so simple, but because you're in a place which was peaceful, you could reflect, and you had some great Kalyana Mittas, fellow practitioners. And that was a time that Ajahn Chah, he decided that he'd built the main hall, which is still there, but he built it on a hill. And he could have very easily got some earth movers, you know, like a bulldozer or something to move that earth, but he decided to get the monks to do it instead. Slave labour. I saw some of the monks out there that are just getting ready for the Katina ceremony, and I just quite innocently said, oh, there's my slaves over there working hard. They're not slaves, obviously. But I know how just it's great to be able to contribute to the work, and you do learn a lot in this particular case. You know, we were moving these very a huge amount of earth. Ajahn Chah said, we need to move it just over there. He pointed out where it needed to go. And of course, you know, those days, just eating a bowl of sticky rice, one meal a day, and just rotten fish curry, or if you were lucky, a frog, it was not much to eat. So, believe it or not, I was really, really thin. You may have seen some photographs of me, and then. So, I'm just making up on it these days. Just, you know, just to balance, you know, to get. But I was really, really thin, and you're weak, and you're pushing these really heavy barrows of earth through the steaming jungles of Thailand, you know, being bitten to death by mosquitoes, pushing it. And after, I did have a lot of faith, a lot of gratitude, you know, for an Ajahn Chah, all the stuff which he taught me. But after 3 days, you didn't have any time to have a shower or wash your robes, because you're working from the meal finished by 9 o'clock, and then you're working till about 9 o'clock in the evening. And you know, when you finish work, you just lay down and fell asleep straight away. You're just so tired. So it must have really stank. But after 3 days, we'd finished. And I thought, following day, I can wash my robes, have a good shower, catch up on my meditation, and relax. The next day, Ajahn Chah had gone to another monastery. And the second in charge, Ajahn Liam, was the boss. And after the meal, he said, you know, I've been looking at that pile of earth, it's in the wrong place. We should all move it. And I still, you know, he was a good monk, Ajahn Liam. And so I thought, okay, we'll move it. And so another 3 days of hard work. Bitten by mosquitoes. Dirty, stinky, no rest. And of course, after 6 days, we'd finished. I thought, oh, great. And the following morning, Ajahn Chah returned that night. And after the lunch, I thought I told you to put the earth over that place. You put it into another place. Move it. And that was a bit too much for me. I'd lost all my faith. I think, why can't these senior monks don't have to do any work? They just sit there talking to people, getting fat. As the small ones like me, we had to do all the work. It was just unfair. Especially if you come from a place like, you know, Europe, England. You know, you've got a fair. This is exploitation. You know, you can't do this. And I was really upset and I'm getting very angry. I lost all my faith. Now, why can't they decide to, you know, to where to put this, you know what, earth? I started swearing. I always swear in English. I swear in English. So the Thai monks can't understand what you're saying. But what happened was that they did. They saw the body language. You can't hide things. And that was where this great monk, I don't know who he is, but I'd always be grateful for him forever. He came up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, it wasn't Ajahn Brahm, they're just Brahm. It is pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. Thinking about it is the difficult part. Doing it is easy. Oh, crikey, that's how wise that was. So building a nun's monastery in England is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part, as you know. Meditating is easy. Thinking about it is the difficult part. Getting your lift back to the airport and going back to Singapore, that's easy. Thinking about it, I don't want to go. I like it here. I don't want to go back to work. That's the suffering. So simple things like that, now those are real insights which help you in all parts of your life. The insights into the nature of existence. So many people get those wrong. All they do is actually write books about them and argue with people in coffee shops. And you know, what great use is that? And they haven't really understood. But anyway, these little ones, these little insights, they help us. And those insights, they help us become peaceful. So, you know, meditating, thinking about it is easy. It's no, it's hard part. Doing it is easy. You know, sit for an hour, sit for 2 hours. How long have you sat for? What's your personal best so far? You don't think about that. You just sit here. And many people have said this, and it's so true. They're sitting here, and they just sit here, and then just get into a nice meditation. They don't think about it. They just are here and just relax, and they get peaceful. And then they're quite bright and awake, and then they open their eyes, and, my goodness, 2 hours? The clock must be wrong. I never sat for 2 hours before. But it's, you sat for 2 hours, or 3 hours, or 4 hours. It's just nature. Thinking about it, you can't do it. Just doing it, you can. You know, sometimes that 35 years I've been here in Australia, and sometimes I look at all the stuff which you've built, all of the books that have been written, all of that, and you think, my goodness, how on earth did that happen? Have you ever in your life you look back and think, wow, it's a huge amount of work and a huge amount of progress. How do we do that? And it's always, if I'd have known what I was going to have to do, I would have run away back to Thailand. But just one day at a time, one brick at a time, one line at a time. You know that, just on that, just see that book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, that we managed to find the... did you see the original manuscript? Yeah, I think you did. I know, but Cecilia's got that now. Because the original manuscript for that, it is manuscript, written by hand. And these were those stories in Opening the Door of Your Heart. And how I did it was, I was telling these stories for years. And they were insightful stories which really helped people. And it was a local girl who's going through a divorce. And, you know, hopefully none of you ever have to go through a divorce. Those of you who have know just how painful and difficult it is. And it's just, you know, one of the most painful bits of suffering that you'll ever have. And so she went through this very, very difficult divorce, and she was suicidal. And she came very, very close many times to killing herself. And it was only the stories which I was telling in this group in Armidale which kept her alive. And she was so grateful for that. She said, Ajahn Brahm, look, you know, you just can't just keep those stories to yourself. You have to write them down and publish them. And I said, no, I can't do that. No time. Actually, I did have the time, it's just laziness. You know, I relax to the max. And there's not that much difference between laziness and relaxing to the max. But she was such a smart girl, smart woman, because you know what she did? She thought, okay, I write the stories. And I don't know if she did this on purpose, but she made such a terrible job of writing those stories down. And I thought, oh my goodness, I can't let her do this. So I had to do it. So I said, okay, I'll write them down. And it was much easier than I thought. 1 hour a day, I sat down and just wrote them, just longhand. And it's got the manuscript, which I wrote. And there's hardly any mistakes on it. It's just write it down really nice and clearly. And straight, without any interruptions, without having to force it. I always say that when you have to force things, you make mistakes. When you relax and just let it flow, it comes so easily. And then with all the stories written down, I had to get someone else to put it on one of the old CD discs. You know how it got published? They just finished typing it up onto a disc, and then I was going to Melbourne to give some talks. The first talk was at Melbourne University. Maybe about 100 people there. So I gave the talk, and then this woman came out to me afterwards, and she said, I really like your talk, and I'm in the publishing industry. If ever you want anything published, please let me see it first. Straight away. Never needed to look for a publisher. It was just, she asked me, and it was in my bag, and I gave it to her. She was pretty stunned, and that's how it worked. So it's nice when things just flow, you know, in life. You tend to push them. There must be something wrong you're doing somewhere. Your meditation, if you have to push it and struggle and strive, okay, look, it's only one day to go. I've got to really go for this. That never works. Just sit down and relax. Just let it happen. So that's actually the insights I get from my life. You know, this place over here, just, you build it, and it's just, things go wrong, things go right. And it's wonderful. That's the meaning of our life. And we just improve it today, improve it tomorrow, all sorts of stuff. But this is little by little, just like a human being, like a forest, like planting a garden. Little by little, it teaches us a lot, and just how to don't have big plans, little plans, and things just work out by themselves. If they don't work out, that's fine too. I always thought that when I first took over, when that other monk disrobed, the one who I was, my senior, Ajahn Jhakara, then I thought, oh my goodness, can I do this? And I thought, what do you mean, can I do this? Can I teach? Can I lead? I said, look, it's a win-win situation, no matter what happens. If I give talks and people hate them and walk out, yes! Now I can have a nice, simple life as a hermit, which is what I would really like. But if I go out there and people like my talks, yes! Now I can inspire people and to do a service to the Dhamma. So either way, it works. And I learned that, of course, from Ajahn Chah when he got sick. You either get better or you die. Either way, it doesn't last, so what are you worried about? So, thinking like that, or looking at life like that, it's just you have a positive attitude. People do make choices in life, but a lot of times when they make a choice, even to meditate, to have a rest, it is sometimes we feel so guilty about the choices we make, that so we spend so much time, should I do this, should I do that, we waste so much time making choices. So, a long time ago I saw through that. It doesn't really matter what choice you make, as much as what you do after you make the choice. So, you make a choice. Should I build a nun's monastery, or should I just go off and just be a hermit nun somewhere? What am I going to do? So, you can spend so much time thinking and thinking and thinking and driving yourself crazy, driving yourself nuts. So you just do it. So once you make that choice, I'm going to do it, you never look back. You save all the energy from making whichever decision you made work. You turn left or you turn right, doesn't matter which way you go. Save all your energy, so when you turn left, you make it work. If you turn right, you make it work. So that's always the idea of saving energy. Don't waste it making choices. Should I change my job? Should I carry on? Should I renounce? Should I? People just dither like that for years. They just do it. Whichever choice, and then once you've made the choice, do it. That was the other great insight which I got from Ajahn Chah. This is real insight meditation, because this actually works, it's not theories. And this was when, actually, you know, he sort of implied this a lot, but I never got the real clear example until this gentleman from Sydney came to visit me in Perth and told me one of the anecdotes which never got into any book from Ajahn Chah, except the one which I wrote. And there was no second-hand story, but it's typical Ajahn Chah. This man from Sydney had heard that there was a great monk living in Thailand, and so he was busy with his family and business, but he decided that he would go and visit Ajahn Chah all the way to Wat Pa Phong in the northeast of Thailand, for one reason over only, to see Ajahn Chah, ask some questions and then go back to Sydney. No holidays, no sort of sightseeing. So Sydney to Bangkok, Bangkok to Ubon on the plane, from Ubon a taxi to Wat Pa Phong, and then he found Ajahn Chah surrounded by people. He couldn't even get close to him, actually, to ask any questions. He sat there for about 2 or 3 hours until he realized he was not going to get anywhere close enough to ask his questions. You know, sometimes it's, you know, nowhere near as famous as Ajahn Chah, and hope we'll never get like that, but even now that sometimes you wait for me after lunch, just no chance. And the people close, all they really want, click! Holy water. So I don't know if you agree with that holy water stuff, but it's always good fun, the holy water. I really like holy water. And I've got some great holy water stories. Ajahn Chah's holy water story. Sometimes. He really pushed his luck, Ajahn Chah. Because this was a time when the generals were running Thailand. And there was a military junta. And so you don't argue with a general. You know, they can make you disappear, even if you're Ajahn Chah. And so this general came with his entourage and a lot of soldiers, even with guns, but they, you know, kept at a distance. And this general, major general, you know, big shot, came right up to Ajahn Chah and just bowed and just said how much he enjoyed the Dhamma of Ajahn Chah. And then he said, "I came here for a blessing. You know, have you got any holy water?" And Ajahn Chah didn't have any holy water there. And so he said, "Well, I wanted a holy water blessing." And so Ajahn Chah is very innovative, makes use of whatever he has. So he said, "Come here." And so, you know, Ajahn Chah was sitting on a bench or a seat like this. The general down there said, "Bow your head." So the general bowed his head. "Okay, teddy bear, you be the general, okay?" Bowed his head. And Ajahn Chah went spat all into the general's hair and then got his hand and rubbed it in. And I and many other monks thought, "You really have crossed the line this time, Ajahn Chah." Spat into a general's hair and rubbed it in. It was amazing to watch that general. He lifted up his head, had a big smile on his face. Wow, this is really unique. No one else gets that holy water straight from the dirty mouth. Remember, he would chew betel nut as well, you know. That was a bit of red stuff on it. The general loved every minute of it. Ooh. So, my holy water story is meditating all night, as we did every week, once a week. And in the morning, a bit tired, a bit groggy. So he went out to urinate in the forest. I think it's in the forest. So, you know, it's, sometimes people call it unhealthy, but the animals do it and it's all right for them. So anyway, you know the way that you urinate in Asia? You squat down. You squat down and then you urinate. It's in the forest. I really thought, well, maybe it's because I'm a bit tired, the first light of day, it's not very clear. I really thought I was urinating on a stick. Quite a thick stick. And as I was urinating on it, it started to move. It was a snake, a venomous one. I was urinating on a snake. And of course, when you squat down, you know, please excuse me, but the most sensitive part of a man's body was only a couple of inches away from this mouth of the snake with all its venomous, painful fangs. But was I bitten? No. That snake, I didn't even run away. It just was there, because the snake obviously understood it was being blessed with holy water. And warm holy water too, in the cold forest. So not many snakes get blessed like that. It's a very lucky snake. But so, sometimes the insights which you get in those places, you know, it's not just the water, it's just where it comes from. Just the good energy, the happiness, the joy, the giving, the fun. That is really important to connect to people. It's just basic kindness. So I was going to actually, somebody said, "Why do I find it so much more difficult to be kind and love myself than to show others love and kindness?" It is. It's crazy, isn't it? Why is it we treat others different than ourselves? And so that's a lot of time, it's our cultures. We're always supposed to sacrifice ourselves and always just work hard for others. But then when we do any loving kindness, we always realize that you're included, you're part of it. So that's why, what was it, the story of the seven monks in the cave? How many haven't heard the story of seven monks in the cave? Ah, there's quite a few, amazing. Okay, so there were seven monks. This is actually based on a story in the Theravada, only loosely based, but it's based on that. There were seven monks meditating in a cave in the jungle. Now, I'm going to ask you a question about this, so don't. So listen very carefully. The seven monks were the head monk. Can it work with seven nuns? Sorry? Okay. Seven nuns meditating in the cave. And the head nun, very clever, very smart, good meditator. The second nun was her sister. They'd grown up together, obviously sisters. The third nun was her best friend, also became a nun. The fourth nun was an enemy. They just couldn't get on together. They had a personality clash. They just could not understand each other. And the fifth nun was a really old nun. You know, just so old. I don't know if you saw Venerable Gotami the other day, but, you know, much older than that. And she could die any day. And the sixth nun, she was a very ill nun. She had so many diseases that no one knew who would die first, the old nun or the sick nun. And the last nun was the useless nun. I always say at this time, whenever she meditated, she snored. Whenever they chanted, always chanted out of key. Whenever she was wearing her robe, it always fell off. He never did anything good for anybody. But there she was there, out of kindness, working a big nun as well. So the last nun was a useless nun. And then this band of robbers, these thieves, they came to that cave. And the thieves, the head thief, she said to the other nuns, so if the people in the cave are women, the thieves are women as well. Okay, fair, fair. So the head thief said, notice this great cave, a beautiful hideout, you know, where they can stash all their stolen goods until the heat goes down. They can hide from the authorities. It was perfect, except those pesky nuns had found the place first. So they decided to kill all the nuns, to slaughter them all, so that none of them would be able to tell the police. But the head nun, she knew how to, as they sell ice to Eskimos. She knew how to, she was such a great talker. So she said she managed to convince the band of thieves, why do you want to kill us? It's only because you want to make sure we will never let anybody know where the location of the cave is. We won't. But, you know, you need to make sure that we know you're serious. So the head of the thieves wanted to murder, to kill one of the nuns in front of all the rest, to show how serious they were. And they let all the other nuns go free. But they said, if you tell people where this cave is, we will come for you, we will find you, and we'll do the same to you. This is how we can make sure you understand that we're serious about this. And that was the best deal could be made. At least six of the nuns would survive. One would have to be sacrificed. So Sometimes people have these terrible, terrible choices. Who will die so others can survive? And this choice was the head nun's choice. So if you were that head nun, who would you choose? Now go through the list again. There was, what was it, the head nun, her sister, her best friend, her enemy, old nun, sick nun, and the useless nun. The useless nun has never done any act of good karma in his whole life. Maybe this was her chance. The old monk, they're going to die soon anyway. You know, just maybe lessen their suffering a little bit. And the troublemaker nun, you know, you've got to live in harmony together. It just caused so many headaches, that trouble. Maybe it's an opportunity to get rid of her. And of course, you know, the other nuns, they'd do anything for one another. So if you were the head nun, who would you choose? You're very smart not to make an answer. Because you know all these all the questions I ask are always trick questions. So who thinks sacrifice yourself? Who thinks one? Very good. Who thinks the useless nun? The old nun. Can die. You must have all heard it or read the book or something. No fun these days. And the answer was, of course, she couldn't choose. Couldn't make a decision. Because her love for her best friend was no more, no less than the love towards her sister. She loved even the enemy, no more, no less than the others. And the old nun, the sick nun, even the useless nun. The love was absolutely even, equal for all of us. And most importantly, she loved herself no more, no less than everybody else. Couldn't choose. So you treat others exactly, no more, no less than you treat yourself. And I'm a bit sort of cheeky and not really mean, but sneaky sometimes. And I told that story, but it was monks, not nuns, in Sacramento a couple of years ago. And because the gentleman who came to my talk was a bishop in the Episcopalian Church. And I thought, I'm going to have some fun with this guy. A bit mean. But it wasn't that, it was just for a good reason. I told him that story. And of course, you know, he said, oh, he sacrificed himself. Of course he sacrificed himself. Everybody thinks like that. I said, no, he didn't. Yeah, his love for others was exactly the same. So just like I mentioned, I just quoted his Bible to him. This is your teacher, Jesus said, to love your neighbour as yourself. No more, no less. Which means to love yourself as your neighbour. He said, yeah, that's really interesting, that's good. That was an insight. He said, can I use that? I said, of course you can. So he used that in his next sermons. Those are the insights which we get. Why is it we don't love ourselves as we love others? You know, one of the reasons, a few weeks ago, there's one place I go, if I possibly can, every year, is to Curtin University for the Curtin Medal Day. So at university, they also say it's not just about academic progress or research. They also value people who go in the community and just do things which other people think are impossible, who make a difference, who help and serve, and show leadership, you know, a bit of courage, and also a commitment to their values for the community. And I always like going there because they always, there's amazing people who don't get in the newspapers who actually do great service for the community. And so, 2006 or something? Anyway, they invited a Buddhist monk to receive the medal. So when I received that medal, the John Curtin medal, John Curtin was was a wartime Prime Minister of Australia. So when I received that medal, you have to give your acceptance speech. And my acceptance speech was, well, honestly, I don't know why you gave it to me. There's other people in the community who do much more work than I do, and I'm just doing this. This is my job, my duty. It's nothing extra. But thank you. Oh, also, I couldn't have done this without the help of all my friends, all the supporters. But thank you anyway. And the next year, this person who... What was this? Well, same this year. This year there was a woman who started... You know, she was an abandoned child, and so she was adopted. And you know, it was a very difficult time being adopted. So once she got through her childhood and found a partner and got a family, she decided to spend a lot of her life making sure that she could adopt children. Now, having brought up her own children, and she's adopted about 50 or something children over the years, but also to actually start running the West Australian Adoption Agency. Basically, just the government run, to make sure she knows she's been there, that kids who are adopted, you know, are really looked after. And you know, kicking butt in the government if they don't fund this properly. And so she was a really amazing lady. And, you know, the reason I like going to this, because, you know, just, wow, it just really sort of inspires you, just what goes on under the scenes in all societies and how people really serve. But then she gave her speech, acceptance speech. Exactly the same as all the other speeches. And my speech as well. I don't know why you gave this to me. There's many other people in the community who are doing much more work than I'm doing, who deserve it more than me. And I couldn't have done this without the help of my kids and my husband and all these other people in my team, but thank you anyway. And I realize that people are so self-deprecating that when they are praised, they refuse to accept it. Because that's what I did. I said, no, I don't deserve this. And then afterwards I realized, hang on, there's some really smart people in this university who've done their research who said, I do deserve it. Maybe I do. And that was really an eye-opener. Maybe I do deserve that medal. And then afterwards I thought, hey, maybe I do. Yeah, I probably do. So now when anyone praises me and thanks me, I said, yes, I deserve that. So, it's been a really good retreat so far. So, what about the retreat manager, Eileen? Has she been a good retreat manager?
Yes, she has.
Do you deserve that?
Yeah.
How difficult is that to accept praise? Difficult, isn't it? Venerable Chanda, you've been an inspiration sitting up there being a bhikkhuni here. Hasn't she?
Yes.
Do you deserve that? Now you understand why it's so hard to love yourself. You're not supposed to. You're supposed to get a big head if you accept praise. If you love yourself, you get big ego. But you know, a lot of the so-called big egos, the trumps, they don't love themselves. They're afraid of themselves. They're always trying to prove something. They're not relaxed. They're not kind to themselves. So what I've found is if you really do love yourself, you're at peace with yourself, yeah, you make mistakes, but you learn from them. And you're a much more balanced individual when you love yourself. You treat yourself like you treat others. So I think Mr. Trump treats himself like he treats others. That's why, you know, what he says to others is terrible, but you have compassion for him. Because that's how he treats others. That's how he will treat himself.
But the Christian community actually seems to endorse him, you know?
Endorse him. Well, it doesn't matter who you endorse or don't endorse. You don't endorse people, you endorse goodness and kindness and truth and people who stand up for something much more than their particular community. Stand up for our world and stand up for peace. Not just make America great, but make the world peaceful. If America's great, other countries have to become small. And that's not fair. So anyway, the last little piece of Ajahn Chah wisdom inside, and I never finished it because this was the guy who went all the way from Sydney to see Ajahn Chah. So he couldn't get to see Ajahn Chah. 3 hours, he just gave up and he walked away. That's all he went there for, just a wasted trip, he thought. But then his taxi was not going to pick him up for another hour to catch the next flight back to Bangkok. So he saw the monks sweeping the grounds. So he picked up a broom and helped. That's one of the most important things. You know, it's not just going there and just asking questions. It's like serving, helping other people, being kind. So he was sweeping the grounds, and he told me he sort of felt a hand on his shoulder. And he turned around, and that hand belonged to Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah had seen him, but hadn't had a chance to go and say hello. But Ajahn Chah never had any time to say very much. Through the interpreter, the translator, he said to this man from Sydney, "If you're going to sweep, give it everything you've got." That was his words of advice. If you're going to sweep, give it everything you've got. That wasn't just trying to get more work out of his volunteer. It was much deeper than that. He thought about that all the way home on the plane and realized it's not just about sweeping. It's about when you work. When you're at work, you give it everything you've got. When you are resting, you give rest everything you've got. When you're meditating, everything you've got. You're not working when you're meditating. You're not with your family when you're meditating. When you're meditating, you're with your mind or whatever. And when you're with your family, everything you've got. You're not thinking about work or meditation. Whatever he did in life, he gave it everything he got. And he said his business just boomed. Great family life, really nice meditation, and doing wonderfully well in life. Simple teaching. So, you know, when you meditate next, give it everything you've got. When you have your lunch in a couple of hours, give it everything you've got. And of course, I usually say this towards the end of the retreat or Katina day, and when you give donations, you know there's a punchline there somewhere. So anyway, so I've gone over time. We can actually do a little offering of robes for those who want to. So anyway, so sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good.